Welcome. I'd like to start by saying a big thank you to the organisers for inviting me to present at this conference. My name is Sam Hutton, and I'm probably a bit of an outlier as far as conference speakers are concerned, because I'm not really an academic. I used to be an academic, and I still have a visiting position at Sussex University, but for the last few years, my main involvement with eye tracking research has been through my role with SR Research, who manufacture the iLink range of eye trackers. So, in the interest of full disclosure, while I've been involved in eye tracking research one way or another for well over 25 years, it's SR Research who pay my wages. Having said that, of course, any opinions expressed in this presentation are entirely my own. I was given the very broad remit of providing an overview of how eye tracking is used in research into cognitive function. This is a sort of mission impossible, because that's a topic that could easily extend to a rather long lecture series and presents a few challenges when all I have is 40 minutes. So what I'll do is start with a very brief overview of the history of eye tracking in the context of cognition, partly because it's quite an interesting and fun topic, at least to me, but mainly so that I can use this as a way to introduce some of the technical aspects of eye tracking. One of the things I can do in 40 minutes is hopefully demystify eye tracking for those of you who may not be actually doing it already. Apologies in advance to those members of the audience who are already familiar with this material. I'd also like to spend a bit of time looking at some of the assumptions that underlie the use of eye tracking in cognitive psychology, including the so-called eye-mind hypothesis. Again, this will be a kind of excuse to sneak in some basic background information, such as why it is we even make eye movements in the first place, and also introduce some basic concepts and terminology. Again, apologies to everyone for whom this is familiar ground, but sometimes it's good for even the most seasoned eye-tracking researchers to give some thought to the often implicit or unstated assumptions that underlie the use of the technique. In the second half of the talk, I'll go through some specific examples of how researchers, mainly me, have used eye-tracking to gain insights into a range of cognitive processes. This is an entirely random and completely unrepresentative selection, but hopefully these examples will serve to illustrate some of the approaches that are used to analyse and interpret gaze data. If I don't run out of time, I'll finish this section with a quick look at a relatively recent trend, which is to use eye trackers to measure changes in pupil size, which are associated with changes in cognitive or mental effort. So before we get to the question of why it is that people want to measure eye movements in the first place, let's take a quick look at some of the ingenious techniques that researchers have come up with over the years in their quest to figure out exactly what it is that people are looking at. Eye tracking devices can be traced back to the tail end of the 19th century. I could give an entire lecture just on Huey's device alone, which was truly remarkable. It basically involved gluing a metal rod onto people's eyes with plaster of Paris. The other end of the rod is attached to a little wheel, which also has a needle on it. The needle is hooked up to a spark generator via a 100 Hz tuning fork, so you have 100 sparks a second shooting out of the needle, and these basically burn holes in a piece of paper that is mounted on a slowly rotating drum. Given the topic of this conference and the talk, I just want to point out that if you look at the data that was collected with this device, you can clearly see that the poor person whose eye was being tracked is reading. These circles are fixations, the trail of dots between them are saccades, and you can see the progression of fixations and saccades from left to right, and then the large return saccade to the start of the next line of text. Over the years, several other devices were created that I don't have time to discuss, but notable examples include the Dodge photochronograph, which actually tracked a corneal reflection in much the same way as modern video-based eye trackers do. It was capable of producing exquisite data. These traces are from people with various psychiatric disorders, looking at a target that alternated from left to right. You can clearly see tiny corrective saccades that even some modern video-based eye trackers would not be capable of detecting. The modern era of eye tracking really began with Jarbus in the 60s and 70s. The gaze traces he created are iconic and often shown in talks about eye tracking, but perhaps less well known is how he actually created these traces. He used a variety of techniques, but most involved cine cameras and tiny mirrors mounted on the eye via a suction cap. One of his other innovations actually involved painting tritium on the eye and filming its radioactive glow, so even back in the 70s it's probably not a great deal of fun being a participant in an eye-tracking study. Over the last few decades, all sorts of different eye-tracking technologies have been developed, from electrooculography and infrared reflection devices, which is the technology I cut my teeth on back in the 90s, to scleral search coils, which continue the tradition of sticking nasty things into people's eyes in the name of science. There are also devices like this, which is a dual Purkinje eye tracker, an incredible electromechanical device that didn't really tolerate head movements at all and required participants to be stabilised by a bite bar. Nowadays, thankfully, most modern eye trackers are video-based and are far easier to work with and a great deal more comfortable as far as participants are concerned. I'll very quickly try to explain how modern video-based eye trackers actually work. There are three main components: a high-speed video camera that essentially films the eye, an infrared light source that illuminates the eye, and some eye-tracking software that both makes sense of the images being supplied by the camera and also provides some interface to the eye tracker, allowing the researcher to set the system up, calibrate it, and also monitor gaze in real time during the actual recording. The infrared light source is actually doing two things. It's illuminating the eye so that the camera can see it, but it's also creating a corneal reflection, which is this light blue dot towards the bottom of the pupil. For various reasons that I don't have time to go into, eye trackers generally track the locations of both the pupil and the corneal reflection. The video camera is just a digital camera, like the one in your phone but faster. Modern eye trackers can shoot at up to 2000 frames per second. The most critical component is the eye tracking software itself, which does a number of jobs. It receives and processes the images from the camera, essentially determining the location of the centres of both the pupil and the corneal reflection. From that information, it computes the location of gaze, typically in screen pixel coordinates. It does this via a calibration procedure in which targets with known screen locations are presented. The software may also parse the data, and by that I mean the software marks the onset and offset of fixations and saccades, as well as things like blinks. The software may also be able to broadcast the gaze data to the computer that is running the experimental task. In fast eye trackers, the end-to-end delay, the time between the eye moving to a position in space, the camera taking a photo of the eye in that position, sending that data to the software for processing, the software figuring out where on the screen the eye is looking, and then sending that data back to the experimental computer, can take less than 3 milliseconds. And what this does is it enables researchers to develop gaze contingent tasks in which the thing that the participant is looking at depends on where they are currently looking or where they have looked. This is an example of a gaze contingent window task here, where somebody is reading, and as they read the text, the letters are revealed. So the only letters that you can see are the letters that are the focus of gaze. Another quick bit of background, and another apology for everyone who already knows this stuff, but it's important that we're all on the same page. The reason we move our eyes at all is because there is only a very tiny portion of our retina that actually has enough cone cells to be able to see in any detail. The fovea itself is capable of resolving only about 1 or 2 degrees of visual angle, about the size of a coin held at arm's length. The rest of our retina is receiving very low quality information, but thankfully our brain does a great job of filling everything in and making us feel like we can see everything clearly. So we move our eyes with rapid saccades to orient the fovea to a new part of the visual scene. This results in a fixate, saccade, fixate sequence of eye movements that you can see plotted here as a scan path and here as a temporal graph, with time along the horizontal axis and location along the vertical axis. The red rectangles are fixations and the vertical yellow bars are the saccades. As you can see, the saccades are relatively short, which is a good thing because we are essentially blind during saccades. Now let's quickly consider some of the assumptions that underlie eye tracking and the reasons why people have invested so much ingenuity and effort into developing the technology that allows us to do it. If you look at the eye tracking literature as a whole, you can identify two main rationales, or almost traditions, that seem to guide the research. There is actually surprisingly little overlap between these traditions. The first tradition focuses on the eye movements themselves. You can think of it as a neuroscience-based approach. People are studying eye movements in order to understand how the brain works. Unlike something complicated like the mind or cognitive function, the output of the oculomotor system is very limited. The eye doesn't really do much. It can basically be in a specific orientation at a specific point in time, and thanks to our wonderful technology, we can measure when and where it is with great precision. Thanks to this fundamental research, the neural systems that govern eye movements themselves are actually very well charted, and this has allowed researchers to explore how different patterns of eye movements or abnormalities of eye movements are associated with different pathologies and disease states. In other words, researchers can use and measure eye movements, and in particular abnormalities of eye movements, in order to make inferences about which part of the brain or which neurotransmitter system might be involved in various pathologies. This is data from a 1908 paper that used the Dodge photochronograph to document abnormal smooth pursuit eye movements in dementia praecox, which is what schizophrenia was called back in the day. This is actually a very large literature, and one of the key assumptions that is made is that specific patterns of ocular motor abnormalities can be mapped onto specific neurological or psychiatric disorders. This almost certainly isn't actually the case, but that's the topic for another talk entirely. The second rationale, or tradition, is led by researchers who are less interested in specific details of eye movements themselves and are more focused on trying to understand where people are looking and what they are looking at. In this sense, researchers in this tradition are less interested in tracking eye movements such as saccades and smooth pursuit in and of themselves, and are more interested in tracking gaze, what it is that we choose to look at. This is the approach that is clearly most relevant to this presentation, and is the approach that underlies the use of eye trackers in the vast majority of psychology and psycholinguistic settings. It's also the approach that underlies the research that I'll describe in the next half of this talk. At the heart of this approach is the relationship between gaze and attention. This relationship is so close that where we are looking and what we are attending to are often assumed to be one and the same thing. And while this may be true much of the time, it's worth noting that it's definitely not true all of the time. We're all perfectly capable of looking at one point in space but attending another. For example, we can be politely focusing on the face of the person we are talking to while desperately attending the door so that we can spot our friend as soon as they enter and wave them over to rescue us. Whilst gaze and attention aren't always in exactly the same place, it's generally assumed that measuring where the eyes fixate can tell us something about what information it is that people need in order to achieve their goals. In other words, it can tell us what information people have chosen to allocate their limited processing and resources to. This whole idea is encapsulated in what has become known as the eye-mind hypothesis, which states that there is no appreciable lag between what is being fixated and what is being processed. There is another way to think about eye tracking in the context of cognition, and that's to appreciate that each saccade is a decision. This is how I generally conceptualize things. Each time we move our eyes, we are making a really important decision, or two decisions. We have to decide where to move our eyes, so which bit of the visual scene is most likely to contain the information we need in order to achieve our current goal. And we also decide when to move our eyes. Have we sufficiently extracted and processed all of the information we need from the current location of gaze? Don't forget that we're blind during saccades, so they come at a cost. Like all the decisions we make, our gaze decisions are not just based on exogenous information, what's out there. Clearly that's an important driver of what we choose to look at, but so is what's in here. Things like our expectations, our beliefs, predictions, memories, goals, even aspects of our personality can all potentially feed into this decision. This approach was developed by Carpenter, who pointed out that if you add up all of the neural delays involved in our noticing that a visual target has appeared and actually shifting our gaze to that target, they come to only about 80 milliseconds, and that's much shorter and less variable than the 160 to 200 millisecond latency that a prosaccade towards a target would typically take. So what's causing this extra delay? Carpenter argues that the extra time is what allows the decision process to unfold, the careful weighing up of both external and internal sources of information that allow us to be sure that where we should look is here and when we should look is now. So hopefully this introduction has provided some insights into both how and why researchers might be interested in measuring gaze in order to understand cognition. In the remainder of this talk, I'll go through some specific examples of how researchers, mainly me, have used eye tracking to gain insights into a range of cognitive processes. This will be an entirely random and not at all representative selection, but hopefully these examples will serve to illustrate some of the more common approaches that are used in the analysis of gaze data, which is one of the more challenging aspects of eye tracking research. Let's start with a fairly obvious one, which is to explore the role of attention in face processing. These scan paths are from research I did at Sussex years ago. It's long been known that elderly participants are worse than young participants at accurately detecting certain facial emotions, such as fear. So by eye tracking young and elderly participants, we were able to see that elderly participants were often simply looking in the wrong place, at the mouth region rather than the eyes. For most emotions, and particularly fear, the eye region is where the most useful information is. This can all be quantified very easily by creating interest areas or regions of interest and doing things like counting up the number of fixations in each or summing their durations to give dwell time. And sure enough, if you do that for each of the interest areas, you can find nice statistical differences between the young and the elderly participants on those metrics. It's worth noting that in this case, eye tracking has in some senses simply kicked the research can down the road. We can say that elderly people aren't as good as young people at detecting fear because they're looking in the wrong place, but of course that just begs the question of why they aren't looking in the right place. You could of course develop further hypotheses and test them. For example, maybe elderly people are more likely to suffer from hearing difficulties and so have learned to focus more on the mouth region because they rely more on lip reading. That would be a testable hypothesis, and there are no doubt many others. This next study is one of my all-time favourites. It was actually a student project and it ended up being published, which is something I'm very proud of. It's long been known that gaze itself is a very powerful attentional cue. So if you present participants with stimuli such as these, in which gaze is clearly directional, and then flash targets either on the left or the right, you'll find that participants are much quicker to detect congruent targets, that is, targets that are on the same size as the direction of gaze, than incongruent targets, such as the one illustrated here. This is true of button press reaction times, as well as saccade reaction times. So I totally failed to convince my student to run some complex variant of this basic cueing type task, and like many students, she was much more interested in doing something less theoretical and a bit more applied. What she wanted to know was whether gaze cues would also influence how we look at magazine adverts. If you look at a typical glossy magazine, you'll notice that in the adverts, in nearly every case, if they contain a model, the model will be staring directly out of the page. I suppose the idea is that this will somehow grab our attention. My student asked the question, wouldn't it be better if the model actually looked at the product being sold? Because then the readers might follow the gaze cue and be more likely to view the product itself. This seemed like a reasonable idea and a testable hypothesis, so I agreed to let her have a go. She spent a great deal of time scanning in real adverts and then photoshopping the model's eyes so that they looked like they were gazing at the product. This turned out to be an incredibly difficult task to do well, and pilot testing showed that people just spent their entire time staring at the obviously photoshopped eyes. But the student wasn't deterred and decided, along with her housemates, to dress themselves up in their best party gear and stand in front of various curtains and make their own adverts. They made about a dozen adverts, and each advert had two versions, one with the model staring out at the reader and one with the model staring at the product. The adverts were all embedded in an online magazine. The participants were told to read as if they were killing time in a waiting room. As per usual, we created interest areas and ran the numbers. And if you look at the dwell time to the product region, sure enough, people look longer at the product if the model themselves are also looking at the product. Perhaps surprisingly, the effect also spills over into the brand interest area. We were able to show via a scan path analysis that having looked at the model's face, people were then more likely to look at the product if the model was looking at the product, and then having looked at the product, they were more likely to then look at the brand. It was all great fun, and I'm happy to say the student got a well-deserved first-class degree. Of course, eye trackers are a great tool for measuring attentional biases, and attentional biases are everywhere in psychology. This is another student project where we used a dot probe type task in order to look at attentional biases to food. Unlike the classic dot probe task, which just delivers a single reaction time variable, eye tracking delivers a wealth of measures, and you can easily present two stimuli at the same time and then determine which was looked at first, most often, or for the longest. I think in this study we found that people looked more often and longer at food versus non-food items, and that this effect was heightened for high-calorie versus low-calorie foods. There are all sorts of different preferential looking tasks like this, and they're very commonly used in different psychology fields. The next study I'll describe illustrates how eye tracking helped gain some understanding of how participants perform a simple decision-making task. The task was devised by Rob Rogers, and neatly captures the key determinants of any decision, namely what are the potential gains and losses associated with the decision I make. So the task is set up as a series of choices between two gambles. The gains and losses associated with each gamble are given by the figures, and the odds of winning the gamble are indicated by the height of the bars. In the vast majority of trials, the yellow bar is always a baseline or control gamble, a 50-50 chance of either winning or losing 10 coins. The other gamble shows a 70% chance of winning 20 coins, but, by inference, a 30% chance of losing 80 coins. The task is played with real money, and participants get to keep any profits, so they should be motivated to make careful decisions. This is another example where the wins and the losses of the experimental gamble are in fact balanced, so this should clearly be preferred over the control gamble. In this example, the odds of winning the experimental gamble are low, and the costs of losing are high, so the control gamble would be a sensible choice in this case. There are some sneaky trials like this one, where what is basically a guaranteed loss of 40 coins is pitted against a 50-50 chance of either zero loss or a loss of 80 coins. Many people choose to take the risk of the controlled gamble in this case and avoid the definite guaranteed loss. In trials like these, on the other hand, where you have a guaranteed win pitted against a 50-50 chance of either winning 80 or losing nothing, many people choose the experimental gamble over the control and pocket the guaranteed money. So it's a lovely task, and it delivers a simple behavioural measure, the percentage of experimental gambles chosen over control gambles, and a reaction time measure, which is simply how long people took to make the decisions. Both of these measures can be plotted as a function of wins, losses and odds, all of which can be classed as high versus low. So what did we learn by eye-tracking people as they did this task? It was actually quite interesting. As before, the analysis starts with defining interest areas. We defined areas for the win information, the loss information, and the odds. This is just some very basic fixation count and dwell time data from the wins and losses interest areas. And it just shows that people generally look more often and longer at the wins region compared to the loss region. This is perhaps not surprising, given that the gambles themselves are framed positively, with the odds indicating the likelihood of winning rather than the likelihood of losing. But notice the values. They're rather low. On average, people are making one or even less than one fixation to what should be critical pieces of information. We also noticed a lot of variation between participants. We can get some sense of what is going on by looking at some individual scan paths. Here's an example of what I guess it is we assumed was happening when people did this task. Someone is clearly taking in all of the relevant information, the win information, the loss information, and the odds, even reading the labels to be sure they've got it right. Here's another example of the same kind of behaviour. But it turned out that these are actually somewhat atypical scan paths. There were lots more that looked like this, with the wins and loss information being completely ignored. Here's another example. And it gets even worse. Some people clearly latched on to the fact that the yellow gamble is nearly always the 50-50 neutral control gamble, so they don't bother looking at it at all. They just make a single saccade and fixation to check whether they have a better chance of winning the experimental gamble. And finally, there are people like me, who just wanted to know how much things were going to hurt. So we decided to group participants based on their eye movements or gaze behaviour. We identified three main strategies: fixating both the win and loss values roughly equally, preferentially sampling wins over losses, or simply ignoring both wins and losses. The key question is, do these different gaze strategies predict performance on the behavioural measure? The bottom line is they do. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the behavioural data clearly show that participants who fail to take the win and loss values into account by failing to fixate the numbers also fail to modulate their decisions based on this information. In fact, they make suboptimal choices and tend to go home with less money compared to participants who did what we initially assumed everyone was doing, which is to take in all the available information. So I guess the moral of the story is that participants aren't always doing things the way you think they are, and sometimes eye tracking can shed some light on what is going on. There are lots of other examples of how simply recording people's eye movements while they do certain cognitive tasks can provide insights. This is the matching familiar figures test. The task is to decide which of these six cats is the exact match for the one on the left. It's actually a very challenging task, and people often respond relatively quickly and get it wrong. You can usually rule out a couple of examples fairly quickly, but then choosing between the others can be tricky. If you haven't got it yet, the correct match in this case is number one, but the difference between number one and, say, number four is actually quite subtle. It's an old neuropsychological test of visuospatial processing, but it can also be used to measure impulsivity. Here's another example with a flower that's even harder. I think the correct answer here is six, but again, choosing between six and four requires real care because the difference is very subtle. So what happens if you track people's eyes while they perform this task? This is something I did an awful lot because I think it's a great task, but the reason I'm mentioning it in this talk is because it provides a nice example of how you sometimes have to go beyond just counting the number of fixations and dwell time to interest areas and get a bit creative with your eye-tracking analysis. So of course we can create interest areas around each of the images and compute the usual metrics such as the number of fixations, dwell time, etc. But that isn't always enough. In one study, I was trying to detect differences in cognitive function between a group of healthy controls and a group of people who had taken fairly industrial quantities of ecstasy back in their youth and were now complaining of various subtle memory deficits. It turned out they were perfectly normal on every neuropsychological task I threw at them, and none of the standard gaze metrics on this task distinguished them from the controls either. But I could see that their scan paths looked subtly different. The one measure that reliably differentiated the ecstasy users from controls was the amount of time that they spent looking at the comparison images before having to go back and look at the reference image to refresh their memory. In an entirely different study, we were able to predict scores on various scales of obsessive-compulsive personality traits by simply counting up the back-and-forth eye movements that occur towards the end of the task as people narrow things down to their last couple of choices. Being able to actually quantify what is effectively checking behaviour in this way has all sorts of potentially interesting applications in clinical psychology. I'd like to take a very quick look now at how eye tracking has been used in the study of reading. As we saw earlier, some of the earliest eye movement recordings ever made were of someone reading. In fact, language researchers have been the driving force behind many of the technical innovations in eye tracking, both in terms of recording devices and analysis techniques. It's an enormous literature, and I'm not going to be able to scratch even its surface. But over the years, several key facts have been established. Fixations during reading are relatively short, at least compared to fixations during free viewing, and saccades are relatively small, advancing gaze 7 to 9 characters on average, although obviously things like the font size will be important. We tend to fixate content words over function words, so we don't bother fixating little words like of and a. Critically, about 10 to 15% of saccades are what is known as regressions, saccades that take the eye back to some earlier part of the text. These are particularly prized in reading research because they tend to suggest that something has gone wrong with parsing. So how do reading researchers quantify and interpret gaze data? As you can see, we can create interest areas for each word, but even for a simple sentence like this, simply plotting the fixations and saccades over the text doesn't really tell us much. We can maybe see that certain words were skipped and other words were fixated multiple times, but that's about it. For paragraph reading, it's even harder to tell what's going on. The image on the right is actually recorded from a research project I was involved in which I recorded a single professor of English reading an entire Henry James novel, another fascinating project that I don't have time to talk about now. Luckily for that project, we weren't particularly interested in the reading data in any traditional sense, but you can see how complex any such analysis might be. Breaking things down into a sequence of fixations makes things a bit easier. We can get a better sense of which fixations are regressions, for example. The key point that I want to get across here is that all of this is a lot easier than it actually looks. Modern eye tracking software basically does all of the heavy lifting for you. It can automatically create interest areas at the letter, word, phrase, or even sentence level. Each interest area is assigned a sequential index, which allows a wide range of standard reading measures to be derived at the click of a mouse. Various different reading measures can be interpreted as being indicative of so-called early or late effects, but exactly how specific measures should be interpreted is often the topic of considerable debate within the field and is not something I'm going to discuss further. Again, the key point that I'd like to get across is that none of this is particularly difficult, thanks to recent advances in hardware and software. The only other thing to mention about reading research is that it often takes advantage of the gaze contingent functionality offered by modern eye trackers. Things like boundary crossing, moving windows, or moving mask tasks such as this one are all widely used. They can be very powerful techniques for exploring things like preview effects. Eye trackers can also be used to study spoken language comprehension. I don't have time to go into detail, but in the visual world task, participants typically listen to sentences played over headphones while looking at a grid of images, at least some of which may be relevant to the sentences being spoken. In the English language, a sentence like "the dog hated the shark at the boxing match because he" creates a parsing ambiguity. When you hear the word "he," it is not clear whether it refers to the dog hated the shark because he hated everyone, or to the dog hated the shark because it had bitten him. So the key question is, where are people looking when they hear the word "he"? Do some verbs, such as hated, bias you towards one or other interpretation? Visual world data is extraordinarily rich and can provide real profound insights into the temporal aspects of language processing. What we see plotted here is the probability of gaze being in each of the four interest areas, with time along the horizontal axis. So as the sentence unfolds, we see peaks for the various interest areas that reflect the sentence contents. The dog hated the shark at the boxing match because he. If we zoom into the critical time window around the ambiguous pronoun he, we can see that some verbs do indeed bias you towards one interpretation over the other, although the effect is admittedly small. I think I just about have time to say some very quick words about pupil size. There's abundant evidence that pupil size increases with mental effort or cognitive workload. These are clearly very vague concepts, and their relationship with equally vague concepts such as arousal are the topic of considerable debate. The main point I want to make is that pupil size essentially comes for free with eye trackers. If you think back to the earlier explanation of how video-based eye trackers work, you'll remember I said that the eye tracking software is trying to determine the centre of the pupil and corneal reflection. Well, it can't really figure out the centre of a circle without knowing its area, so eye trackers compute pupil area for every sample, in other words up to 2,000 times per second. The second point that I want to make is that the muscles involved in changing pupil size are made of smooth muscle fibres. These are very slow fibres, quite unlike skeletal muscle fibres. Pupil size does not change quickly. Another challenge is that lots of things influence our pupil size, most notably luminance levels, so some thought needs to be given when creating stimuli for pupillometry research. Finally, it's also important to remember that the camera is viewing the pupil from a fixed location. As such, rotations of the eye will result in changes in the pupil area that are essentially artifactual. So it's critically important to make sure that any differences in pupil size across conditions are not simply the result of systematic differences in gaze location across conditions. The example I always give is finding that pupil size is greater when viewing happy faces compared to frightened faces. Can we conclude that processing happy faces is somehow more effortful or cognitively demanding than processing frightened faces? Only if we can be sure that people aren't systematically looking more at the eyes of frightened faces than the mouth of happy faces. The mouth will be closer to the bottom of the screen and therefore closer to the camera, and therefore the pupil will appear very slightly larger to the camera when people look at the mouth compared to the eyes. So what have we learned? Well, it's probably much nicer being a participant in an eye-tracking study now compared to times past. No one is trying to shove anything unpleasant in your eye, and there are no nasty bite bars involved. Modern eye-tracking hardware and software really is very accessible, and I struggle to think of any area within psychology in which eye-tracking isn't routinely used. Recording eye-tracking data is really very easy. I regularly teach people to do it in an afternoon, but interpreting gaze data does require a bit more practice. One thing I didn't get a chance to talk about is combining eye-tracking with other neuroimaging techniques. This is a very popular and very powerful approach. Finally, video-based eye-trackers basically give you pupil data for free, but some care does need to be taken in its interpretation. Thank you all for listening, and apologies for the terrible audio quality. Please do let me know if you have any questions.